someone who has experienced what really is, if that person can help those who would like to leave our burdensome living. And they continually get tripped up on the language, because as soon as they talk about helping, then we again fall into the main trap that they keep identifying, which is our way as human beings of assuming that there's something wrong that we have to fix first, and then we could get on with living. And they come to this one point in the dialogue that I read a couple of days ago that I found very, very clear, that I really liked. And it's strong. It's kind of like you might read the sentence and then have shivers through your body and just stop. And it's a point that Krishnamurti makes often, but I found that in the context of this dialogue, it is more accessible. So they're trying to find out what could someone do or not do that could help someone who's interested in what is really living, what really is and what really isn't, to experience that. And they identify this, our main problem, as what they call improvement. Our main problem is that we're constantly trying to improve. And the way I would like to put that in general is that we are usually falling into a place of feeling not good enough, that something is wrong with the world or with me, depending on if we have more of character disorder or neurosis. We would blame outwardly or inwardly or both, that there's something wrong, and from that, that's our motivation to get up and do something, or sit down and do nothing, or lie down and do nothing. And what Krishnamurti points out from his experience is that no matter what we have ever done or not done, with that motivation, the motivation of improvement, the motivation of not good enough as the stick that's getting us going, which what that means, we can go backwards even a little bit further to kind of get the point clearly. We deeply believe that the only way to get ourselves to do something good is with a stick, is with some, let's call it outer motivation. And what I would like to say is that we could even take out the word outer. If we do anything with a motivation, then whatever we do, whatever will happen, however good, will actually have no connection with reality. So whatever improvements we might have actually made that we're glad that we made, to the extent that those are in our inner life, in our psychological realm, all of that has actually and absolutely nothing to do with what we're talking about doing, where we're talking about going, etc. So they continually acknowledge a difference between practical knowledge about things that can be helpful to have. It can be helpful to know how to drive a car or how to plant beans or whatever, how to use a fork or your fingers to get food into your mouth, and how to chew the food or whatever. And it could be worthwhile improving those skills to chew better, for example, or to drive more safely. But when we apply that same principle to the inner world, they say, then we've gotten off track. And the way I would put that today is that we've then stopped using the nose. We've not just gotten off the track that's been beaten, that we should walk upon because everyone walks on, but we've lost the possibility of following the track that we need to follow by sniffing, by following our nose. We've disconnected from that sense and that possibility, that probability. So we can just check in ourselves. This is just a general introduction landscape that we can then walk through more in detail. That what if most of the time, whatever we do and whatever we don't do is motivated, period, has a motivation. has a reason that we think is the reason that we're doing it. We want to get something. We want to get away from something. And especially we might want to get better at. We might want to get knowledge about. And then we could, just for a split second before we think too much about it, get a feeling sense inwardly of how wrong that feels, of how false it feels. So the way Krishnamurti then puts it is, when we have that shocking moment of actually feeling, of experiencing, that all that I've done to improve myself has no relationship with what is, which is. It's not that there isn't something, which they call the ground. So beyond emptiness and creative energy of all different flavors and colors, something that they call the ground. That when the mind is quiet, but not stuck, so there's a stillness, but there's a stillness and a silence as a quality, but there's also the fact that it does move, it can move us. So this is this other kind of movement that's not for any reason. There's from the stillness and silence, a fluidity, that a flow that can happen, that has no motivation, has no reason, and has built into it a kind of humility and groundedness. So I like the fact that David Baum and Krishnamurti choose the word ground for this absolute, for this what is, for this reality. Because I do think that the perspective on what we call civilization that some scientists have and some ecologists have, that the more civilized, in our word civilized, the more civilized a civilization becomes, the less topsoil they have, literally. The more their topsoil, the more their humus has washed away. And the more civilized they get, the less grounded they are, in a really basic, simple sense, grounded. But I think that really basic, simple ground is related to the absolute ground. And that when we can let things and ourselves be simple, then I think we do feel more often a flow that bubbles up that would move us, that we would agree with if we felt it was our life, if we felt we were free to. So then we can play with unknotting and untangling and unlatching and unlocking ourselves from the sense that we're being paid to live a life the way we're supposed to, or we'll be kicked out if we don't live the way we're supposed to, and that we are free. I want to talk in a little bit more detail in this geography of the possibility of fluid movement from stillness for no reason as the freedom of a human being. I want to talk about love, and I want to talk about hate. I want to talk about friendship and enmity. If that's okay. So there's, in the Indian spiritual traditions, including the Buddhist traditions, a lot of emphasis on friendship, maitri, metta, and how important that is for daily living, as well as for the mind being in a state that's receptive for insight. And I love how specific and technical we can get with some of the Buddhist texts, where they'll say the far enemy of friendship, friendliness, metta, love, is, of course, hatred. But the near enemy is not so obvious, is envy. And I think this is one of the places that in our, what should we call it? We can't really call it Western anymore, Western culture. Mainstream or dominant or post-industrial culture. It's about time that we got around to addressing our fear and competitiveness with those that we would otherwise look up to. And so maybe we need to start with changing the phrasing of looking up to, because when we think of looking up to, then we feel down. So this is something, this is an aspect in the human psyche that's happened for thousands of years, that when we're near something or someone that we would love, instead of loving, we feel envy. So obviously, when we come from a place of lack, that I need, oh, I have so much improvement to do, when I'm around that person, I'm aware of how much improvement I have to do on myself, and I feel terrible, it's impossible. And so instead of outrageously hating that person, I envy them, which still creates distance. It doesn't allow a natural flow of, we can even use the word following, which will get our hackles up. It will get us upset as good civilized people who shouldn't follow. But there would be a natural way, it's not following necessarily another. It's following what resonates in another person with what's streaming in us, and which would grow in us if it would be allowed to be exposed to that long enough, and then allowed to go its own way when it's time. Does that make sense? Is it getting too abstract? If you think of someone that you love, not in a so much interpersonal way, but in a little bit, if we can say cold way, or you might not even like the person, but there's something about the person that speaks to you. One way we could put it is that there's some work that can be done in connection with this person. Some work in myself can happen by being near this person, whether I like the person or not. So there could be friendliness there. Rather than being intimidated, feeling small, feeling lack, feeling the need for improvement mode, if we feel a more abundance mode, a more fluid mode, a more why not mode, then whether I like you or not, I'm not required to like you to follow. I'm not required to accept everything you do to follow, to let something in me follow. That's something in you, not everything in you. Does that make sense? And then there are things that can't be done otherwise. They need to be person to person, and they can happen by being in touch, by staying with myself and letting a following happen. Not my idea of following, that would be like having to follow, a forced following, a should, but a natural allowing, like the way the birds, when they fly in a group, and there's no hesitation, and that's how it can happen, that group flow. So if we can allow that stirring to happen, be aware through training of the subtle stirrings that are there, the subtle would-be followings that would like to happen, that would love to happen, that can happen. And to let that be without more than that. It's simple, ordinary. So then to be aware when we feel envy, when we feel competitive, when we feel comparing, when we feel intimidated, when we feel a movement of the mind that says better than, is it really the opposite that's true, so to speak, if there has to be better than, worse than? Or can we call into question the whole need for comparing and competing? So then we can come to the enmity part. There's a teaching of one of the older preserved teachings of Gautama Buddha called the Atadanda Sutta. That's the Dart Sutta. A sutta would be like a condensed thread of a teaching that passes on more than it looks like it's passing on. And it's such a beautiful teaching because it feels very, you can feel the vulnerability of the person of Gautama looking around as we do today, hearing around as we do today, and feeling around as we do today all the bad news that there is, and how hard it is to accept that we live in this world with all the violence that's going on, for example. How hard it is to accept that any day some devastating event could happen through another person's insanity, not being taken care of by the community and lashing out on someone. And potentially, you know, it doesn't have to be, but potentially devastating the life. And so at that time also, Gautama Buddha looked around, and before he was Buddha, and saw what was unbearable to see and tried to find somewhere to get away from it. And what's different with him that I love about his sort of kind of arrow-like intelligence is this not stopping. Like, it's not, he's just following through his one thought all the way to the end. I want to get away from this. You know, to me, I'd be like, yeah, I want to get away from this, but I would pretend that I don't want to get away from this or something. He's like, I want to get away from this. This really, really, really sucks. This is not livable. This is not bearable. I want to get out of here. So he's looking for a place of refuge somewhere in the world, inwardly or outwardly. And he keeps going until he can finally say, there isn't a place. There is no place of refuge. And then he's in a, obviously a point of despair, which is kind of heartwarming to know that when we're in a moment of despair, it could be that moment. We can let the shock be that kind of shock, the despair be that kind of despair. We're not quite giving up. And this is another quality of the of Gautam, who then was awakened. Through that following through on what he thought was needed, get out of here, and finding out I can't get what I wanted. My first thought comes to an end that isn't fruitful. So then, is it a matter of now giving up, or is there some other way? And so that confidence or that opening or that willingness to be, so, what I would say today, so completely in despair, not like in despair but trying to hide it from myself and others, but like despair, that then he got a glimpse of what's going on. Why are people, as he said, like fish in water that's dissolving, like water that's evaporating, fish in a pond that's getting smaller and smaller, flapping around, running from exhaustion? Because then he got a glimpse of the dart in the heart. And so today we're talking about the dart in the heart as the lack and the belief that, or whatever you want to call it, belief is not quite strong enough of a word, the mode of operation, that the only way is to be motivated by motivation. The only way is to move because of some reason. Call it improvement in the Buddhist language, becoming, being motivated from the sense that lack is what's most deeply true, or wrongness is what's most deeply true. The possibility of something else. At the end of this teaching, at the end of this sutta of the dart, where he sees the dart and he hurts the lack that's, of course it makes us squirm like fish in too little water, because it hurts. And so if we could have that like straightness and following through and either completeness of confidence to be, if I'm in despair, despair. If I've tried my best to find an answer and what I found was that I can't get what I want, then letting that that opening happen. Like, oh no, if it's that kind of opening, or if it's that kind of opening. And then the opening, there can be a glimpse, some deep intelligence that manages to catch a glimpse, the feeling of the dart. And then it's the dart that can be removed. And when the dart is removed, so the dart of lack, improvement, becoming, whatever word you like, that even Gautam's language was that we would run until we were exhausted, until the dart is removed. After the dart is removed, that wise one doesn't even lift a finger. He doesn't say it that way, but doesn't even lift it, doesn't bother even to lift a finger about better than, worse than, or even equal to. That whole mode of enmity, the whole mode of comparing. So speaking of metta, one of the poems I wanted to share from Wendell Berry, who's a poet from the United States, who's still kicking, who moved back to his family's landscape in Kentucky in the southeastern United States to farm it after trying out being a beatnik poet in New York City. The poem is called To My Mother, and I'd like to just make an echo with the word mother, first of all, to the sutta, the teaching about metta, about friendliness from Gautam Buddha, where the final climactic example to try to explain what is this friendliness all about is like a mother for her only child. That much love. That much 100%-ness of allowing the friendliness to be and to transform both persons. As well as this feeling of the soil and the ground as another experience of mother, because many of us haven't had an experience of biological mother that we would turn to understand friendliness. But it looks like Wendell Berry maybe did, so it's always good to know as possible. To my mother. I was your rebellious son. Do you remember? Sometimes, I wonder if you do remember, so complete has your forgiveness been. So complete has your forgiveness been, I wonder sometimes if I did not precede my wrong and I erred, safe found within your love. Prepared ahead of me the way home or my bed at night, so that almost I should forgive you, who perhaps foresaw the worst that I might do. So it's all one long sentence. I'm going to go back and wash through it that much of it again. I was your rebellious son. Do you remember? Sometimes, I wonder if you do remember, so complete has your forgiveness been. So complete has your forgiveness been, I wonder sometimes if I did not precede my wrong, and I erred, safe found within your love, prepared ahead of me the way home or my bed at night, so that almost I should forgive you who perhaps foresaw the worst that I might do and forgave before I could act, causing me to smile now, looking back, to see how paltry, how small, how weak, how nothing was my worst compared to your forgiveness of it, already given. And this, then, is the vision of that heaven of which we have heard, where those who love each other have forgiven each other, where, for that, the leaves are green, the light, a music in the air, and all is untangled, and all is undismayed. So I think hearing the poem, it sounds more complicated than reading it, so I'll just say a little bit about it. I think the basic idea comes across, does it? That no matter what he did, the mother was ready that it would happen. And already had his bed ready for him to come after the night was over. The possibility of forgiveness already given, so that we don't hate the world for being how it bees. Possibility of not just for a child that we've given birth to, but the possibility of that kind of feeling for another person that we don't know. It's a kind of power that looks disempowered today. But if we would get inside the feeling of it, it's a power that's empowering both. Forgave me before I could act, causing me to smile now, looking back, to see how paltry was my worst compared to your forgiveness of it already given. And this, then, is the vision of that heaven of which we have heard, where those who love each other have forgiven each other, where, for that, the leaves are green, the light a music in the air, and all is unentangled, and all is undismayed. I want to put that poem together with partly because sometimes this word forgiveness, if we hear it in the wrong way, as something that we should do, as a must, as if an agreement with actions that are not just disagreeable but unbearable, if we could feel how the forgiveness is coming to it, actually at the ground, coming to a different place. So Wendell Berry is talking about heaven, and he even capitalizes as an H, but I don't think he means heaven, not on this ground here. But it is as if another dimension. It is as if another world. Where things are simple in that. So he's just saying, he's not saying heaven about angels, he's saying heaven where leaves are green and light is a music in the air, just like right now. And where would be the place in the realm of human being, in what dimension can we find we already exist that allows that light to be a music and allows the leaves being green to be heaven? The second poem is called In a Motel Parking Lot, Thinking of Dr. Williams. And it's longer, but in a way it's very simple, which I like. I may not read all of it, let's see. He's kind of talking to himself as a poet. He says, there's part one, with a big Roman one. The poem is important, but not more than the people whose survival it serves. One of the necessities, so they may speak what is true and have the patience for beauty. And then he gives a colon, the 2 points to say, what do you mean by beauty? Or maybe also, what do you mean by speaking what is true? But just to say, he's calling one of the necessities poetry, so that the people who need poetry may speak what is true and have the patience for beauty. And then the colon, the 2 dots. For the patience for beauty, the weighted grain field, the shady street, the well-laid stone and the changing tree, whose branches spread above. For want of songs and stories, so he's talking about a kind of lack here, that comes about when we act from lack. The wind keeps warning other poems, changing the page. For want of songs and stories, they've dug away the soil, paved over what is left, set up their perfunctory walls in tribute to no god for the love of no man or woman, so that the good that was here cannot be called back except by long waiting, by great sorrow remembered and to come, by invoking the understones of the world and the vivid air. The poem is important as the want of it proves. So he's talking again about lack and what happens when the lack of what's needed is, then the lack comes out into the outer world. It is the stewardship of its own possibility, the past remembering itself in the presence of the present, the power learned and handed down to see what is present and what is not, the pavement laid down and walked over regardlessly by exiles, here only because they are passing. Oh, remember the oaks that were here, the leaves, purple and brown, falling, the nuthatches walking headfirst down the trunks. So thank you for listening, and we'll continue the poem and the podcast once the radio show ends, now in about 3 seconds. I love the way Wendell Berry talks about like this really round, full ground and the world that grows out of the ground with so much love and as a metaphor for love. I love how he talks about the importance and the fulfillment of learning that patience for beauty. So the necessity of things like poetry and beauty, so that then we may speak what is true And when he says speak, I think it's also not just when we say it out loud, but also in the moments that it could be said out loud, that it can be. But I kind of hope, and I have the feeling, because of the examples that he gives, are so much a world that he lives in and so much of a ground, that it's not just about speaking words out loud, but kind of so many other kinds of language, like the language between the body and the ground and the air, body and the air, and the different kinds of intelligence that inhabit the body and the air and the ground, and all that mutual communication and about speaking what is true. So it's like the living, that they may speak what is true, not just like those people with the mouth. So they may speak what is true and have the patience for beauty. The weighted grain field. So he's talking about his work as a farmer and all the work that goes into the bounty that comes also by itself. The abundance of that weight that comes out of the ground by itself. We work, but also it's not us making the grain. The shady street, the well-laid stone. So here in this part of the world, there's still some people who know how to lay stones well. And it takes so much time and so much body wear that you can pay someone to do it, but it's such a ridiculous amount of money to pay someone, both in it's so expensive and it's so little compared to the work that it is. So there's one guy who is the father of someone that we know who has a pig farm nearby. And this man is building this humongous stone wall for his son's pig farm. It's in places, it's like, I don't know, 15 meters high. And it's taking forever, and he's just so happy doing it. It's amazing. He's so proud. So this other kind of pride. And then the fourth example he gives of speaking what is true and having the patience for beauty is after the grain field, the weighted grain field, the shady street, the well-laid stone, and the changing tree whose branches spread above. Something like so plain, but also majestic. And when we have that relationship with the tree, how much comes alive, and how much we are with the changing of the tree. So then this part two gets a little bit more philosophical. The poem is important, as the want of it proves. So the lack of poetry shown in the poverty, the lack of quality in the way of living now, shows us what happens when there's not poetry. It's the stewardship of its own possibility. The poem is important. So the poem as a stewardship. Stewardship is like taking care of. Often it's one way of translating one of the versions of the creation story in Genesis. There's two, and one talks about dominion and one talks about stewardship. So he's referring to that. Stewardship of the earth by humans and all the creatures. Stewardship of all the creatures by humans. So then poetry as stewardship, as taking care of and being dependent on. So the stewardship is that creation story where everything else was created first and then human beings. So we are also the most vulnerable. We need all of those for us to be. It's not just that we're the most special and powerful. So a poem as the stewardship of its own possibility. And then a poem, the past remembering itself in the presence of the present. So letting whatever may have already happened, our past experience, become fruitful, to allow it to get to its fruit and not just be heavy, not just be a burden. I think I need to change this. The past remembering itself in the presence of the present. So letting what comes up, what's unresolved, what's tangled, letting it come in the presence of the present, so in something that's alive now. The power learned and handed down to see what is present. So then he's still talking about the poem, poetry, which includes anything, any of those arts of stewardship, arts of taking care, arts of love, as is. So let's say the poem, or living truly, is the power learned and handed down. So there's also the craft and the skill of it, where we can learn as a power learned and handed down to see what is present and what is not. And then again, we have the colon, the 2 points. The pavement laid down and walked over regardlessly, / by exiles, so people who have been sent away from their home, here only because they are passing. So he's slicing through the modern culture, if we could call it that. They're here only because they're passing. So that the fish in the pond that's too small, there's not enough water to swim in, they're flapping around. The people running themselves to exhaustion because of the dart in the heart has come to this extreme point. Exiles here only because we are passing. Oh, remember the oaks that were here. So this power learned and handed down to see what is present and what is not. Remember the oaks that were here, the leaves purple and brown. So a kind of, especially when we think of mindfulness, the literal translation of mindfulness is actually remembrance. So when we talk about being present, it's not only to be with what's present, but being with what's present in a way that can feel through to what can be, even if it is not. It's not only to be with the cement sidewalk walking down, but also to be with the earth that's below that and that gave birth to that cement. Cement is actually a natural material. But even if the ground would be made of plastic, recycled bottles or whatever, we can feel the aliveness in it. Oh, remember the oaks that were here, the leaves, purple and brown, falling. The nuthatches, which is a kind of bird. But it's probably this particular bird because the word hatch also is like coming out of the egg, the new life. Nuthatches walking head first, which is what he's asking us to do, go head first, down the trunks, crying onk, onk, in the brightness as they are doing now in the cemetery across the street. So the cemetery is where people are buried. Okay. So even if we have to go to now what's dead and gone, to find what is alive and can be present, can be living. We can still hear the nuthatches walking headfirst down the trunks, crying onk onk in the brightness, as they are doing now, in the cemetery across the street, where the past and the dead keep each other. To remember, to hear and remember, is to stop and walk on again, to a livelier, surer measure. So this is this just small gesture in the poem that's the same gesture of Gotam, to stop. You know, we got to the end of the line and it wasn't fruitful. And then something opens, whether it's in despair or in wonder, something can open, or whether it's just shock, stop. Everything that I've done from a place of lack has not helped me be in touch with what's real. Nothing that I've done, no retreat, no meditation, no chanting, no anything, whatever I may have done, no act of kindness, whatever, from a place of lack, has any relationship, any connection to, other than that all the energy that it was used came from somewhere mysterious. To remember, to hear and remember, is to stop and walk on again to a livelier, surer measure. So then we're taken into our own participation in the livelier and surer, so more grounded, more real, more round world, so our own natural rhythm. It is dangerous to remember the past only for its own sake, dangerous to deliver a message that you did not get. And again, he's like a hatchet coming down. Do you feel the poem, or is it hard to hear it without seeing it? He's talking about the importance of whatever may have happened in the past. Some of it was aliveness that could come back we hear it and let it. If we let ourselves be fed with what's needed so that we can speak what's true and have the patience for beauty. So that what has happened in the past and what's been said in the past and what's been alive in the past, not for its own sake, not for some nostalgia, but the aliveness that's in it that can be, that still rings true, can wake us back up, can let us be in touch with that aliveness, so that what has happened can be fruitful rather than tangled. So in the mother poem, at the end, the leaves are green, so it's just simple. And the light and music in the air, it's not only just simple, it's simple and it's amazing, but it's nothing. There's nothing to say, but it's already music by itself. And all is unentangled, and all is undismayed. So the unentangling then happens. When we let the past be fruitful now, in the presence of the present. And then to remember, to hear and remember is to stop and walk on in a livelier, surer measure. It's also the burden of all that we've done for a reason. Doesn't need to be heavy. It was just out of touch, but it doesn't, it's not a weight. It was nothing. It has nothing to do with us anymore. So undismayed, that's like, we're not like, oh no, I wasted my life. There can be that time, as he says, for the sadness in the first part. The walls that are put up, the soil that's dug away, what's paved over, etc. In tribute to no God, for the love of no man or woman, so that the good that was here cannot be called back except by long waiting, by great sorrow remembered and to come, by invoking the understones of the world and the vivid air. So not just talking about them, but feeling what's underneath, behind, and somehow inside. Just in the speech that comes out of the mouth, but in all that other kind of communication. Body to ground, body to air to body, ground to body. Different intelligence of the body, different intelligence of the natural world, the unseen as well. So there can be that long sorrow, but that's also part of its bearing fruit, its bearing fruitfulness from the past wrong tracks. And so that doesn't stay burdensome. It doesn't become burdensome or stay burdensome. So that's the end of the podcast. So thank you for listening, everyone. Have a good evening or morning, wherever you are. Water. Any questions or comments? Any part of the poem that you want to go back to or hear again, or either of the poems?
A bit about the past again, in the present.
Okay, yeah. So in the second part, the poem is important as the want of it proves. So seeing the lack of the poem in these uncaring structures that weren't done for love shows how important poems are. And then the poem is important. It is the stewardship of its own possibility. So it's taking care of that which would give rise to poetry, that would allow that creativity to come. Comma. So then, again, he's like, the song is important. It's the stewardship of its own possibility, the past remembering itself. So, for example, something, whether painful or not painful, whether painful, whether joyful, whether neutral, that comes from the past, that remembers itself, let's say, that's allowed in the presence of poetry or in the presence of opening to what would be the poem of the day. Mm. Then the past can remember itself, which also remembering, like, come back together, like things can start to fall into place, like, oh, this is more important than I realized, this is more important, this past thing, in the presence of the present, so that the presence of the present, so letting the past remember itself in our stillness, in our openness, in our not trying to get somewhere.
Of staying in the present, you know, where it's almost like we've got to put it away, the past.
Yeah.
And I always find, how much is it part of it, of the present, actually?
Yeah.
And how much can I just let it be?
Yeah.
That's the past here with me now.
Yeah.
And it's okay like that.
Yeah.
It's actually, if it's remembering, if it's in mindfulness, and the same a bit with the future, depends how
yeah.
it is.
Yeah.
A bit.
Yeah.
And then it isn't anymore.
Two ways that especially happens is that one is the little bit more mystical where there's less sense of time and there is something from the future or past that visits or is not separate from the experience. And other times where it is part of a process where something from the past would bear fruit.
Yeah.
It would be an experience that even if we would wish no one would ever have that experience, but we did have it
mm-hmm.
and it would bear fruit instead of just being a burden.
Yeah.
By just being, let's not go there.
Yeah.
The technique of now can help sometimes when used
mm-hmm.
in the right dosage or whatever. But there's also, I mean, Krishnamurti talks about it really beautifully. Practicing now, memories will come
mm-hmm.
until we've done finished that work, kind of. A memory will come, and this is the part that maybe we have to say there's three different ways that past, let's say past, future also, but let's talk about past right now, may come when we're practicing presence,
mm-hmm.
when we're allowing the present to be present. And one is that more mystical way, and one is part of a process where, as you're saying, we just be with that for now.
Mm-hmm.
That's all. And other times would be this way that Krishnamurti says, let it come and let it not, he doesn't put it this way exactly, but what I understand him to mean is, let it not be a story anymore.
Mm.
Just let it be a memory that comes, and by not in any way engaging it as my story,
mm.
but knowing this comes now in this present moment, it dissolves. And that's different from, I think there's two, there's like the process and then there's the end of the process. And then the possibility of living not through memory, but not needing memory to negotiate the world or the planet or whatever, but
mm-hmm.
that's processed. And there's like a different kind of transparency and brightness. But the, what he, in the poem, we're mostly talking about is that middle one, where there are things we've experienced for better and worse. He's not talking about only negative experiences,
mm-hmm.
that will naturally come as part of poetry and truly living or moving towards that. And then, so then he says, like, this stewardship of the possibility of poetry, the taking care of that poetry can come, is the power learned and handed down to see what is present and what is not. Which I think feel. A power learned and handed down. So it's an art, which is, again, going back to that patience for beauty, where we're just so much losing touch with this. I'm so glad that he talks about this a lot, because it feels like almost every day, but certainly every year, there's more and more emphasis on in the spiritual world also, to workshop to get skill in the self, and then you go and market that skill, basically. And there's not actually room for learning and for hand for power. And so part of that is where there would be a tie with some people who actually remember those specific species that used to live here and don't now, or that are only over there, that we could bring them back over here. Mm. And part of it is just that a bit more mystical, spiritual. That's what we're mostly talking about here, is just by feeling through into the place, it happens without knowing what the bird is called or what, how it walks head first. Or and just to leave room for that moment, to remember, to hear and remember, is to stop and walk on again, like to let the light be music, to let that happen, to let that have its time also, and then, okay, then we can go make breakfast. So to acknowledge and enjoy that when there's the stop, and then the more alive, more sure, so